today on the Animals Podcast, we had a special guest, Lane Janie, and the following episode is our interview with her. And Lane is a longtime friend of Animals, worked at CB Insights, now works at TeamPay. And our conversation with her is great. We talk about her, you know, early political marketing career, which will be interesting to hear about. We talked about her work at CB Insights, and we talk a little bit about her work at TeamPay, what it's like building a marketing team from the ground up, and yeah, everything in between. So, you know, hope you enjoy the conversation. TeamPay is a tool that we use at Animals, and I have had a lot of fun using and found really enjoyable actually to use. But, you know, maybe do you want to explain it sort of in your own words? What it is, what you guys do?
So, you know, those annoying conversations that you have with your boss about buying stuff that you need to do your job, and they're questioning you as to why you need to buy it. We stop that. And we do that through software. But really, like, besides that, you know, we're a software company that helps you request, approve, and track all of your company spending in one place. We have an interface through Slack. We have a Chrome extension. And we also have a web interface.
Nice. And you're building marketing, basically built marketing from the ground up at TeamPay, and you're running the team there now, right?
I am. Sometimes it feels like it's running me, but yes, I'm running the team.
Awesome. Yeah, I think we definitely want to talk about that more and talk about what it's like building that from scratch. But, you know, we both thought it was fascinating how you got your start in the world of marketing, and how it involves something that's pretty relevant today to how we think about media and politics. And you got your start doing marketing for your mom, who was running for office, right? And was she already in politics at the time, or was it like a, you know, scrappy underdog sort of story?
It was kind of a cool, scrappy underdog story. We were outspent, I think, 4-1. The campaign lasted way longer than expected. And this is kind of, you know, good for the moment to talk about. It was a nonpartisan race because judicial races in Georgia were nonpartisan. So it was really about, you know, experience and getting the right messaging out there. But I was technically the communications manager / chauffeur for my mom's campaign. And during that time, really, the bulk of my responsibilities included public relations, right? So figuring out how to pitch the story of this candidate in a race that nobody cared about. This is like one of those races that you like check who's ever first on the ballot for. Mm-hmm. But it was really important to myself and my mom. So we ended up driving around the state of Georgia all summer in my Nissan Xterra, pitching media. And I think, you know, when you initially had told me that you guys want to talk about that, I'm like, that has nothing to do with content marketing. That's all PR. But really, I think what kind of clicked with me is that the way that you tell your story is different now, right? So, like, this is back in the day, 2004, over 10 years ago. Oh, my gosh, almost 15 years ago. You know, PR and traditional news media were the only way that you could get your story out there. And there weren't any really, like, cool or, like, you know, bloggers that you could trust. So you would pitch, you know, news stations, newspapers, small magazines. I mean, I went to pitch a newspaper where they were still laying out the newspaper by hand, literally on a printing press. the thing could have been from 1750. So we pitched some really, really interesting media with our story, but we didn't get to own our story. So now I feel like, you know, you pitch your story immediately after you publish it on your own. So you have all of these platforms. You have blog platforms. You have your own blog. You have video platforms. There's so many different ways to get your message out there. And basically the model's flipped. You push your story out there, and then the media decides to pick it up or not. It's less of a sort of a pitching effort. But yeah, that's how I got my start. We won. Really exciting.
Congratulations.
And I do think, you know, people it's all sort of qualitative, not very quant. But part of the reason why we won is because we were able to reach those people with our story and with our message on a scale that nobody else could, just simply because they didn't hustle like we did.
Could you paint a picture of what pitching media looked like in 2004?
It would be literally me like finding numbers from the internet and being like, hey, I have this candidate who's in town. So after the Daffodil Festival that she's speaking at, can she come to your newspaper and will you talk to her? And sometimes, you know, it would be like a larger city, like a Savannah or an Atlanta. And we'd meet with like a large reporter or the political reporter. But, you know, if we were in a small town, we'd literally find the newspaper, just walk up and say, hey, do you want to meet this candidate? And they were just so excited that we'd stop by that they'd interview her and it'd be like front page of the paper because they had so little like foot traffic in these like towns with like 1,000 people. And the other part of pitching, I think that we did really, really well is we figured out sort of the emotional aspect, right? Like nobody cares about, well, back in the day, it wasn't as highly politicized a climate. And nobody cares about, you know, some random judicial candidate, especially if they're a nonpartisan judicial candidate. I think what made them care is sort of carrying the emotional story of it, of how this woman who was one of the first women in Georgia to become an attorney and also happened to make DNA evidence admissible in the state of Georgia. It really resonated with people on sort of both sides of the aisle, people who were all crime and punishment and people who were looking for justice, like underrepresented communities. So it was really, really interesting. And I think we tapped into an emotional vein. That was a little long winded.
No, that's awesome. I love that it was so on the ground. What about today? Like, what are there lessons that you pull from that you can apply directly or indirectly to the work you're doing now?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I think, you know, the sort of emotional resonance is something that a lot of content marketers forget about. There's so many outlets and it's such a crowded marketplace that, you know, if you don't tap into an emotional vein, then your content's going to be easily forgotten. And I think that doesn't mean that everything has to be high drama, high stakes. But it does mean that you need to sort of connect with your audience on a level where other media can't. So I think different ways to do that. One way is brand voice, right? At TeamPay, we recently covered the Theranos disaster. And the lens that we tell that story through is very, very different than the New York Times or BuzzFeed. And the reason why we tell it in the way that we tell it in our voice and with our lens is to resonate with our potential buyers who all happen to be in finance. So, you know, really focusing on, this is like the buzzy, yucky word, but like your ideal customer profile, right? Figuring out what it is and not only figuring out, you know, who they are demographically and I think firmographic is a word, but also psychographically. What are their fears? What are their hopes? What are their dreams? What inspires them? What motivates them? In order to create content that resonates. Otherwise, you're competing with the New York Times, and why would you want to compete with the New York Times?
Right. It is kind of similar to what you did, you know, on the campaign trail, except there you're, you know, the sort of subset of people you're trying to reach or hoping to influence is I guess more, you know, geographically concentrated. It's drawn along different lines than, say, we're trying to reach, you know, people that work in finance at SMBs between this size and this size who have this large of a budget. But there's a similar logic to it for sure.
Yeah, and I would actually even go as far to say is it's even the campaign stuff, the political stuff is even harder because not only do you have to get them to vote for your candidate, you have to get them to the polls to vote.
Right.
But again, it's still speaking to their pain points. It's still speaking to their hopes and dreams or their fears, all those sort of like things that they sound like sort of fluffy ideas are more important now than ever because the marketplace is so crowded with content.
So what do you make of now? Obviously we have various candidates trying out their own sort of emotional authentic social media experience, extravaganza from Beto, AOC, Warren, a few others. What's your take on that? And is that sort of effective, or is it only effective for some of them? And maybe if you have thoughts on this, you know, what's the difference between them and what makes them successful?
Yeah, I think, you know, for me personally, Elizabeth Warren's social media presence doesn't work, right? Mm-hmm. And her sort of, it doesn't feel authentic, right? That whole opening a beer and then looking into the camera, it felt very produced. And I think with Beto and AOC, they're sort of like, you know, what they used to call digital natives. Mm-hmm. They get it. They understand that, you know, social media content essentially isn't a commercial. It's more about the authenticity. As far as what they're doing well, I think, you know, AOC has figured out a way to use her platform to get across the messages that she wants, right? She does it so well on Twitter. I think Beto, it's a little more blurry. It's a little shiny. It feels sometimes he can feel like the fire festival of candidates, like so much, you know, like how, and I, but I think that's something that candidates and brands are going to have to deal with. How do you be authentic, but also, you know, attract customers, attract voters? I don't think that there's a right answer. I think it'll be interesting to see, you know, in the upcoming elections, what happens and how they sort of change their stories.
It's kind of interesting how politicians struggle with a very similar problem that content marketers do, which is that when someone tries a format or a concept that proves itself, then everyone else piles on, but only one, the first one, can be the one that was authentic, right? It's kind of like in content marketing, like someone figured out that 1500 words is the right length for an SEO optimized post, and now all SEO optimized posts have converged and they all look exactly the same, and it works to varying degrees, but you have to fight a lot harder if you're not breaking new ground.
Well, it's interesting because AOC said that she was going to give lessons to other Democrats. And I'm like, I would pay so much money to be a fly on that wall to explain to like Schumer, you know, how to be your authentic self on Twitter would be kind of interesting.
That's like just the ultimate like power. I'm just imagining, you know, LBJ, if you've read the Robert Caro books about his, you know, rise to power, it seems like very, almost very cutthroat move in a way to offer lessons, but you know, got to admire that, obviously, the panache.
Yeah. Right. It's like, she's the alpha. Yeah. But I mean, but also I think, look, there's a level of transparency that these politicians aren't used to. And I think, again, going back to sort of like the brand examples, you know, everybody, it's cool to be a transparent org. It's cool to be a transparent politician. And figuring out, you know, again, how to do that with authenticity is going to be the challenge for everyone going forward. How do you jump onto a bandwagon authentically? I think that there's a way, because I think that, you know, from my PR experience, you're still pitching a story, but hopefully it's a story you believe in and it's a story that you trust. And that creates authenticity. Meh, not a great definition. Sorry, guys.
we'll figure it out. So I think authenticity also, you know, as we were talking about that, sort of plays a big role in other kinds of content people might not see as necessarily requiring authenticity, like investment research, reports, analyses, that sort of thing, which you worked on a lot when you were at CB Insights, where we first met you, and you were there when we first met you. And, you know, I thought sort of an interesting example of a company to talk about, because as opposed to a company like TeamPay or a political campaign, it's sort of a company that's defined more by content, or would you disagree? I mean, I feel like content is sort of part of the core offering.
Yeah. I think CB Insights is a unique situation because all of their content is powered by their data, right? So they have like this unique software that gives them data to power their content that nobody else has. So really their content and their product are almost one of the same at this point, because the content is an example of their product. And they do it, I mean, magically well.
Right. How does that sort of affect how you, I mean, even think about like marketing that sort of thing when the content and product are so intertwined?
Yeah. So I would say it's really funny, because when I first came to TeamPay, I'm like, oh, we just got to do the playbook that CB Insights does. We just have to, you know, use what data we have and expose it. And it doesn't work that way. I'm pretty sure that would be against some type of regulatory body if I started exposing financial data. But I think what I learned from that, and what I took to TeamPay, is, again, the, you know, I keep circling back to this, but how they were able to connect with their, you know, core audience of VCs, investment bankers, people in innovation, through either, you know, fear of missing out or fear of getting screwed, which is, I believe, pretty those are great motivators. So fear of missing out, fear of getting screwed, or, you know, dream fulfillment, wish fulfillment. CB Insights does a lot of that. And you may not think about it as wish fulfillment, but when they come out with, you know, their VC list, every VC in the country has a wish to be named one of the best VCs, you know, in the world or in the country by the New York Times. When you think about, you know, fear of getting screwed, you think about some of the disaster content that they've put out there, you know, doing teardowns of, I believe when I was there, there was one teardown of the biggest innovation fails of all time. Nobody wants to be that guy or gal. So to me, I think what I took from it wasn't necessarily the tactical stuff, but really figuring out that how important that emotional resonance was using fear or inspiration.
Right. Yeah. Is there a sort of consideration there about, like, keeping it balanced between, so you point out the fear and inspiration as two forces, obviously both powerful. I think with recent events in the world, you know, maybe the balance or the scale has sort of been pushed towards the fear end with a lot of the content on the internet. Yeah, I don't know. How do you think about that now?
I think that's a good point, but I think it depends on your brand voice. And I don't think fear necessarily has to be fear-mongering, right?
Right, right.
It's not irrational fear, it's rational fear.
Right.
So, you know, TeamPay example, look, I think people are very concerned about a pending recession. And I don't think that it would be fear-mongering to give some of our finance folks tools to help them combat or you know, surf through a recession. That's using fear, but it's not, again, fear-mongering. I think fear-mongering is you go into that sort of, you know, Breitbart space that's a bit scary.
Maybe it's like emotional, like the emotional resonance is one aspect. If it resonates with your with the people you're trying to talk to, it's emotional. And then authenticity is something, or like it, it's a, you're doing it in good faith, you know, whereas someone like Breitbart might be doing it in bad faith, not truly believing all the, you know, insane things they say.
Well, I think ultimately for me, at least, our content is supposed to help our customers.
Right.
I mean, content creates brand awareness, and more importantly, for me at least, brand affinity, right? If they're getting good content from you, they're going to trust you. And then, you know, even if it's tangentially related to your product, they are going to be more likely to try your product. So sort of surfing, making sure that we stay in that lane has always been important to me.
Cool. So you have been at TeamPay now for how long?
Almost a year.
And so when you started, blog was existent or non-existent at that point?
The blog was existed. It definitely had some gems, but for the most part, it was just very boring. Like somebody told them to hit, you know, these keywords and then try to rank for them.
Right.
So it wasn't very exciting.
Yeah, maybe walk us through like what, you know, your first month or, you know, months, whatever seems more useful to talk about. I mean, what was your sort of approach going in? And you looked at it, you said, maybe we can apply some stuff that I've learned before. But yeah, how was that startup process for you?
Yeah. So, you know, the first thing we did, going back to that ideal customer profile, figuring out who we wanted to buy our product. And this is sort of where the product marketing and the content marketing cross over, and there's a little bit of a handoff. It's like, in my case, I was a sole marketer for a while, so I was everything, but, you know, figuring out your ICP is usually the sort of product marketing role, and then handing it off to content to create content around that will attract that ICP. So we figured out our ICP. I'm very fortunate because our product, it really kicks ass. And people enjoy using it. So we had sort of data on who to target and who to use, which happened to be controllers, VPs of finance, those type folks. So that was sort of step one. And really then I did user research interviews, figuring out, you know, what their day-to-day was, what they already were reading, where the gaps were in what they were reading. So believe it or not, there's not a great place for like finance professionals just to get information on how to do their job better. There's Accounting Today, which is a great resource. There are all the sort of, you know, boards that accredit CPAs, but there's nowhere that tells you how to do your day-to-day job. Like, how do you scale a startup from 50 to 500 people? So that was a gap that we found. And we decided that based on all of our data that we had from our user research, some of it qualitative, some of it quantitative, that was a space that we could fill. So we started filling that space. And the first thing that we did that I think was a really great example is we did a self-reporting survey, the finance software of top performing startups. Mm-hmm. And really what that did is, in terms of it obviously gave us more data to work with as well to see, you know, what the top performing companies were reporting that they were using as tools. But also it was something that we could give to these people who were so hungry for information on how to do their job better. And really, honestly, that was just straight up hustle. We collected the data, we begged people to take the survey, and then we published it. And once it was published, it kind of took off, which was great. And that's sort of how we got our core group. And then, you know, building upon that, once we were able to give them something of super high value, like that report, we were able to attract them to our blog and to our weekly newsletter. Weekly newsletter now is at about 12,000 people. So very happy about that.
Did you sort of use your customers at the beginning for, you know, your initial blog audience or how did you hustle that?
Yeah. So, you know, once we had, because of the success of the finance stack report, we were able to have, we already had that audience, you know, mm-hmm. that group of leads, people who mm-hmm. were aware and who had some affinity for us. So then we started publishing to the blog, and really the way that we publish the blog is on a weekly cadence, and we push it out through our newsletter. So these people who had opted in to receive the finance stack survey were now getting our newsletter as well. You know, that just sort of began to grow and snowball.
Could you tell us a little bit about the ideal customer profile? Obviously there's like a demographic component, like job titles and the type of company that person works at. But I think the thing that I'm really interested in is how you reinforce the idea of an ideal customer profile in a content workflow, right? So that like, as you're doing content for 6 months and a year and 2 years, it like, it continues to stay true to the reader that it's designed for.
Well, in 6 years, you'll have to ask me. I'm not sure. But I can sort of speak to the 2 years, I think. Really, I think what we did before we began our sort of content initiatives was figure out sort of key talking points for our organization and for our product, right? So one of our key talking points with TeamPay is that finance is no longer, you know, a sidelines, on the sidelines. Finance is now a strategic partner with the C-suite. And that needs to be, you know, sort of echoed in our content. That's one of our talking points. And we have a list of about, I would say, no more than 10. So that as we're going through creating content, the goal is to have at least two of those talking points in every piece or reflecting those talking points, right? With the product content that we put out there, because I think a lot of product marketing content that's on blogs in particular is so fucking boring. It like blow your brains out boring. And I think the way that, you know, we're trying to do that, at least, and TBD if we're successful or not, is basically creating, going backwards and solving the pain points and the problems, not just with our products, but with other solutions as well. So, you know, if talking about the pain and the product, or excuse me, talking about the pain points is the way that we like to frame all of our product content. Because again, the emotional core, that's sort of the genesis of our product and authenticity, yada, yada, yada.
It seems like finance is a world where things either go right or they're a disaster. There's not like a, this is just going amazing all the time. So like kind of harping on the pain, like you said, kind of tapping into the fear without fear mongering seems like a really good strategy given the topics you write on and the people you're writing for.
Yeah. And I would say like with any role, that's the case as well. I mean, even in like my, like what is something that marketers are afraid of, or I mean, content marketers, but even more general marketers are afraid of, I'm afraid that I'm not going to deliver the right amount of leads. Right.
Right.
I'm afraid that leads are going to dry up and you know, my business is going to fold because of me. Maybe not everybody feels that way, but really I think that in any role that you have, that's my pain point, right? That is a very clear pain point. And if you can say to me, you know what, Lainey, we're going to make sure that you have consistent leads over the next 6 months, or here's some strategies, then you've got me. You've got me hooked.
Right. Yeah, that's interesting. Pain is I guess a common feeling amongst all of us that marketers can tap into, I guess, regardless of what exactly the topic is, right?
Right. I mean, and it doesn't really matter. I mean, think about like even like if you think about like some of those early like washing or like Tide commercials, soap suds, like back in like the soap opera days. Like the fear that your husband would have a stained shirt. Oh my God. You know, that's kind of, to me, that's sort of like the genesis of everything, figuring out what the pain point is and not necessarily saying like, oh, your husband doesn't have a clean white shirt. He's going to get fired from his job, but saying, hey, you know, the economy is a little bit tumultuous right now. And we want to make sure that your finance team is tight. How can we help you?
Right, right. I like that. I'm curious about, like, you know, since the TeamPay content operation is relatively young, how do you measure it? And do you set goals for page views, leads, email subscribers? Do you have kind of more holistic measurements? Or like, how do you think about that?
So I would say we have probably more down bottom of the funnel goals for our content. I think it was funny because I was listening to your podcast previously about reporting and I was like, yep, experienced all those problems. When you're measuring, you know, visits or users or time on site or any of that, it doesn't feel like you're affecting the bottom line and it can lead you in the wrong direction.
Mm-hmm.
Especially if you're not honed in on your ICP, then you're basically creating content that people enjoy, but it may not be impacting the bottom line. So really we focus on, conversion to demo. as well as, you know, we have some other secondary and tertiary conversions, you know, download a white paper, download a case study, that are really our the metrics that we go by as to whether or not we measure success of a campaign. But also I think the other thing that people forget is they think about content and they think about inbound only, right? Like we use our content, we slice it up in every single possible way. We don't just wait for people to come visit us. We push it out outbound, in terms of our SDRs, use all of our content. Obviously we use it in our newsletter. We put paid against all of our content, which has been very, very successful for us. We do a variety of ways to sort of distribute the content other than just like twiddling our thumbs and saying like, oh, it's good SEO. Great.
Yeah, that's interesting. You know, one thing that's interesting about just chatting with people about how they measure content is I get the sense that some content marketers are hesitant to put, to pay for traffic because it distorts your data in Google Analytics, right? Like it gives somewhat of a false impression of how much traffic you actually get. Because content marketers tend to want to rely more on organic, but it's such a powerful way to drive targeted people to the site.
Right. What does it matter? Like you're paying for it in one way or another. Who cares if it's organic or if it's paid? You may pay upfront a little more for paid, but also I think the other thing that's a problem is that organic takes a long time,
yeah.
Right? Like you have to, when you boost your content with paid, as long as you're getting in front of the right audience, is you're jumpstarting it. And you can prove ROI very, very quickly. So I don't want to give away all of our secrets. But, you know, we've boosted a lot of our content with paid, and the results have been phenomenal.
That's great.
Because we have that ICP. We put it in front of exactly who we want to put it in front of. They download a piece of content, and then they're in our sales funnel. And we have our SDRs reach out to them. And it's also a self-selected group, right? If you're, you know, worried or if you're inspired by something that's related to your job, chances are you're more likely to consider solutions for problems that you already have. So, you know, you're already like, you know, essentially profiling these people by having them opt into your content.
Right. So then two follow-up questions. You're sending people mostly to gated content.
Yes.
And then any suggestions for platforms like LinkedIn, Twitter, Facebook?
Yeah. So everybody in the world's on Facebook. You just have to find your audience. And again, that goes back to your ICP. And I would say with Facebook, experimenting with different filters. Look, Facebook has been really abused by a lot of people. And so the people who were using it in non-abusive ways kind of got punished in some respects. A lot of the third-party data, on demographic data, was taken off the platform. So figuring out how to use additional filters when you're, you know, creating a lookalike audience. So one way I love is to create a lookalike audience, and then add on, you know, an income filter, or add on a must also like XYZ software products, or must also be interested in XYZ, and keep filtering and adding, you know, essentially A/B testing your audiences to find the ones that are the high quality. But Facebook is look, everybody on the world's on Facebook, especially if you're targeting elder millennials. people,
you just
the younger
me.
Millennials. Yeah, me too. So like the people who aren't on Facebook because we want to see every, you know, third birthday picture from your high school boyfriend. You know, those people are still on Facebook. I would say I do not know consumer. Like B2C is very different. And I can't speak to whether or not Facebook works for B2C. I'm assuming it does. But for B2B, it's been really powerful, especially if you're focusing on a more seasoned audience.
Right. And I guess you can probably keep it cost effective by narrowing that audience.
Exactly. I mean, I was chatting with a guy from an ad agency, and he was telling me that some of their top performing campaigns are for car dealerships, like for Ford, Nissan, those type of like large scale or giant auto manufacturers. And what they do is basically the same thing that I do, is they, you know, look for people who are in the market, and then they start adding filters until they find the right one. that is the indicator that these people are ready to purchase. So, and it may not be what you think. So, one filter that's kind of interesting is that we were talking about actually yesterday with a with another agency that I was chatting with, was trip intent. So if you don't have demographic data, but you know that your company or you know that your ideal customer profile is in the top 10% of you know, wealth in the country, you may not know that. You may not have that exact data. But if they have an intent to go on a trip or they're likely to buy expensive consumer electronics, then you can use that as a filter in lieu of some of the demographic data that you're missing.
That's interesting.
Yeah. I mean, look, it's scary at times how much data is out there. But at the same time, nobody, hopefully, you know, people who are working, or I know that I'm not using it in a malevolent way.
Right, right. That's interesting. We could probably do a whole podcast just on how to drive paid traffic to content.
Oh my God, yeah. And that is like, that's like the secret that nobody wants to tell you that you need to do.
Yeah, yeah. That's so interesting.
And I just spilled the beans. Damn it.
So you've had a pretty interesting and successful career to date. Are there any particular skills or moments that you attribute that to, or advice that you would offer to other marketers?
Pick winners. I think really assessing not just what you'll be doing in the role, but the actual overall company. Does it have an exciting product? Does it have a good team to work with? Has sort of been my guiding guidepost. Because marketing, at the end of the day, you're going to be doing the same thing at every company, right? Especially content marketing. So you have to make sure that you have a product that you believe in and a team that you believe in as well. As far as skill set, I cannot tell you how many people can't write. It is painful. There are people who are so smart, can do so much in Excel, can figure out a go-to-market strategy, are like geniuses when it comes to product, but they cannot write. I'm sort of fortunate because my mother used to literally like redline every single paper I wrote since first grade. So I sort of had that instilled in me at an early age. But people need to learn how to write. Marketers need to write. And also, it is probably your most employable skill. I would say almost every gig I've ever gotten since starting as like a copywriter at a magazine, it was because I knew how to edit bad syntax of sentences. It's a skill that is so undervalued in academia, but almost like overvalued in the business world. And I think that there are ways that if you don't feel like your writing skills are up to snuff, you can, you know, work on them. There's so many online courses. There are so many academies. There are so many blogs. There are ways to sort of bring your writing up to a level that you can be in the top 5 to 2%.
And that's good advice, not just for content marketers, but just for any marketers, because of the way we communicate now, right? I mean, emails, Slack, blog posts, reports, presentations, all of it requires good writing skills. That's great advice.
Yeah. And then a robot can't take your job until they learn how to write really, really well.
Yeah. Or it'll take them 5 to 10 years longer to take your job.
But yeah, exactly.
It'll a good it'll 5 to 10 years.
Yeah, exactly. Well, they won't be as funny as you. So
I don't know. They might be funnier than me.
Maybe you.
All right. And that's all the time we have. So
thanks, guys.
Cool. Awesome. Thank you.
Thanks for taking the time.
All right. Bye.
Bye.